A knock came. An evil-looking servant boy, crop-headed and snuffling, wheeled in a trolley and cleared the plates. He made a botch of it, lingering as if expecting a gratuity, but Mick ignored him and stared coolly into space, now and then grinning to himself like a cat. The boy left with a sneer. At length there came the rap of a cane against the door. A second of Mick's friends had arrived. This was a heavy-set man of quite astonishing ugliness, pop-eyed and blue-jowled, his squat, sloping forehead fringed in an oiled parody of the elegant spit-curls the Prime Minister favoured. The stranger wore new and well-cut evening dress, with cloak, cane, and top hat, a fancy pearl in his cravat, and a gold Masonic ring on one finger. His face and neck were deeply sunburnt. Mick rose at once from his chair, shook the ringed hand, offered a seat.
"You keep late hours, Mr. Radley,"
the stranger said. "We do what we can to accommodate your special needs, Professor Rodwick." The ugly gentleman settled in his chair with a sharp wooden squeak. His bulging eyes shot Sybil a speculative look then, and for one heart-leaping moment she feared the worst, that it had all been a gull and she was about to become part of some dreadful transaction between them. But Rodwick looked away to Mick.
"I won't conceal from you, sir, my eagerness to resume my activities in Texas."
He pursed his lips. He had small, greyish, pebble-like teeth and a great slash of a mouth.
"This business of playing the London social lion is a deuced bore.
President Houston will grant you an audience tomorrow at 2, if that's agreeable."
Rodwick grunted.
"Perfectly."
Mick nodded.
"The fame of your Texian discovery seems to grow by the day, sir. I understand that Lord Babbage himself has taken an interest."
"We have worked together at the Institute at Cambridge,"
Rodwick admitted, unable to hide a smirk of satisfaction.
"The theory of pneumodynamics."
"As it happens," Mick remarked, "I find myself in possession of a clacking sequence that may amuse his lordship."
Rodwick seemed nettled by this news.
"Amuse him, sir? Lord Babbage is a most irascible man."
"Lady Ada was kind enough to favour me in my initial efforts."
"Favour you?"
said Rodwick, with a sudden ugly laugh.
"Is it some gambling system, then? It had best be, if you hope to catch her eye."
"Not at all," Mick said shortly.
"Her ladyship chooses odd friends,"
Rodwick opined, with a long, sullen look at Mick.
"Do you know a man named Collins, the so-called odds-maker?"
"Haven't had the pleasure," Mick said.
"The fellow's on her like a louse in a bitch's ear,"
Rodwick said, his sunburnt face flushing.
"Fellow made me the most astounding proposition."
"And?" Mick said delicately. Rodwick frowned.
"I did fancy you might know him. He seems the sort that might well run in your circles."
"No, sir."
Rodwick leaned forward.
"And what of another certain gent, Mr. Radley? Very long of limb and cold of eye, who I fancy has been dogging my movements of late. Would he, perhaps, be an agent of your President Houston? Seemed to have a Texian air about him."
"My President is fortunate in the quality of his agents."
Rodwick stood, his face dark.
"You'll be so kind, I'm sure, as to request the bastard to cease and desist."
Mick rose as well, smiling sweetly.
"I'll certainly convey your sentiments to my employer, Professor, but I fear I keep you from your night's amusements."
He walked to the door, opened it, shut it on Rudwick's broad, well-tailored back. Mick turned, winked at Sybil.
"He's off to the ratting pits. A very low sporting gentleman, our learned Professor Rodwick. Speaks his bloody mind, though, don't he?"
He paused.
"The General will like him."
Hours later she woke in Grand's, in bed beside him, to the click of his match and the sweet reek of his cigar. He'd had her twice on the chaise behind their table in the Argyle rooms, and once again in Grand's. She'd not known him to be so ardent before. She'd found it encouraging, though the third go had made her sore down there. The room was dark, save for the spill of gaslight past the curtains. She moved a bit closer to him.
"Where would you like to go, Sybil? After France?"
She'd never considered the question.
"With you, Mick."
He chuckled and slid his hand beneath the bedclothes. His fingers closed around the mound of her womanhood.
"Where shall we go then, Mick?"
"Go with me and you go first to Mexico.
then north for the liberation of Texas with a Franco-Mexican army under the command of General Houston.
But isn't Texas a frightfully queer place?
Quit thinking like a Whitechapel drab. All the world's queer seen from Piccadilly. Sam Houston had himself a bloody palace in Texas. Before the Texians threw him into exile, he was Britain's greatest ally in the American West. You and I. Why, we could live like grandees in Texas, build a manor by some river.
Would they truly let us do that, Mick?
Her Majesty's government, you mean? Perfidious Albion? Mick chuckled. Well, that largely depends on British public opinion toward General Houston. We're doing all we can to sweeten his reputation here in Britain. That's why he's on this lecture tour, isn't it?
I see, Sybil said. You're very clever, Mick.
Deep matters, Sybil. Balance of power. It worked for Britain in Europe for 500 years, and it works even better in America. Union, Confederacy, Republics of Texas and California, they all take a turn in British favour until they get too bold, a bit too independent, and then they're taken down a peg. Divide and rule, dear. The coal end of Mick's cigar glowed in the darkness. If it weren't for British diplomacy, British power, America might be all one huge nation.
What about your friend the General? Will he truly help us?
That's the beauty of it, Mick declared. The diplomats thought Sam Houston was a bit stiff-necked, didn't care for some of his actions and policies, didn't back him as strongly as they should have. But the Texian junta that replaced him is far worse. They're openly hostile to British interests. Their days are numbered. The General has had to cool his heels a bit in exile here in England, but now he's on his way back to Texas for what's his by right. He shrugged. Should have happened years ago. Our trouble is that Her Majesty's government don't know their own mind. There's factions among them. Some don't trust Sam Houston. But the French will help us anyhow. Their Mexican clients have a border war with the Texians. They need the General.
You're going to war then, Mick?
She found it difficult to imagine Dandy Mick leading a cavalry charge. Coup d'etat, more like, he assured her. We won't see much bloodshed. I'm Houston's political man, you see, and his man I'll stay, for I'm the ones arranged this London speaking tour, and on to France, and I'm the ones made certain approaches as resulted in him being granted his audience with the French Emperor. But could that be true?
Really?
And I'm the one as runs Manchester's newest and best, through the Keno for him, sweetens the press and British public opinion, hires the bill stickers. He drew on his cigar, his fingers kneading her there, and she heard him puff out a great satisfied cloud of cherry smoke. But he mustn't have felt like doing it again, not then, because she was soon asleep and dreaming. Dreaming of Texas, a Texas of rolling downs, contented sheep, the windows of grey manors glinting in late afternoon sunlight. Sybil sat in an aisle seat, third row back in the Garrick, thinking unhappily that General Sam Houston, late of Texas, was not drawing much of a crowd. People were filtering in as the five-man orchestra squeaked and soared and honked. A family party was settling in the row before her, two boys in blue jackets and trousers with laid-down shirt collars, a little girl in a shawl and a braided frock, then two more little girls ushered in by their governess, a thin-looking sort with a hooked nose and watery eyes sniffling into her handkerchief. Then the oldest boy sauntering in, a sneer on his face. Then Papa, with dress coat and cane and whiskers, and fat Mama, with long ringlets and a big nasty hat, and three gold rings on her plump, soft fingers. Finally all were seated amid a shuffling of coats and shawls, and a munching of candied orange peel, quite patently well-behaved and expecting improvement. Clean and soaped and prosperous in their snug, machine-made clothes. A clerky fellow with spectacles took the next seat to Sybil's, an inch-wide blue strip showing at his hairline, where he'd shaved his forehead to suggest intellect. He was reading Mick's programme and sucking an acidulated lemon drop, and passed him a trio of officers on furlough from the Crimea, looking very pleased with themselves, come to hear about an old-fashioned war in Texas, fought the old-fashioned way. There were other soldiers speckled through the crowd, bright in their red coats, the respectable sort who didn't go for drabs and gin, but would take the Queen's pay and learn gunnery arithmetic and come back to work in the railroads and shipyards and better themselves. The place was full of bettering blokes, really. Shopkeepers and store clerks and druggists with their tidy wives and broods. In her father's day, such people, Whitechapel people, had been angry and lean and shabby, with sticks in their hands and dirks in their belts. But times had changed under the Rads, and now even Whitechapel had its tight-laced, scrub-faced women and its cakey, clock-watching men, who read the Dictionary of Useful Knowledge and the Journal of Moral Improvement, and looked to get ahead. Then the gas lights guttered in their copper rings, and the orchestra swung into a flat rendition of Come to the Bower. With a huff, the limelight flared. The curtain drew back before the kinotrope screen, the music covering the clicking of kinobits spinning themselves into place. Broken frills and furbelows grew like black frost on the edges of the screen. They framed tall letters in a fancy alphabet of sharp-edged engine Gothic, black against white. Edition Panoptique presents... And below the kinotrope, Houston entered stage left, a bulky, shabby figure limping toward the podium at the center of the stage. He was drowned in dimness for the moment, below the raw and focused glare of Mick's limelight. Sybil watched him closely, curious about him, wary. Her first glimpse of Mick's employer. She'd seen enough American refugees in London to have ideas about them. The Unionists dressed much like normal Britons, if they had the money for it, while Confederates tended to dress rather gaudy and flash, but peculiar, not quite proper. To judge by Houston, the Texians were an even queerer and madder lot. He was a big man, red-faced and beefy, over 6 feet tall in his heavy boots, his broad shoulders draped in a long coarse-woven blanket, rather like a mantlet, but barbarically striped. Red and black and umber, it swept the Garrick's stage like a tragedian's toga. He had a thick mahogany cane in his right hand, and he swung it lightly now as if he didn't need it. But his legs shook, Sybil saw, and the gold fringe trembled on the fancy seams of his trousers. Now he mounted to the darkened podium, wiped his nose, sipped at a glass of something that plainly wasn't water. Above his head the kinotrope shuffled into a coloured image, the Lion of Great Britain and a sort of long-horned bull. The animals fraternised beneath small crossed banners, the Union Jack and the single-starred flag of Texas, both bright in red and white and blue. Houston was adjusting something behind his podium, a small stage mirror, Sybil guessed, so he could check the kinotrope behind him as he spoke and not lose his place. The kinotrope went to black and white again, the screen's bits flickering row by row like falling dominoes. A portrait bust appeared in shaded, jagged lines, high balding forehead, heavy brows, thick nose bracketed by bristling cheek whiskers that hid the ears. The thin mouth was set firmly, the cleft chin upraised. Then, below the bust, the words, General Sam Houston. A second limelight flared, catching Houston at the podium, flinging him into sudden bright relief before the audience. Sybil clapped hard. She was the last to finish.
"Thank you very kindly, ladies and gentlemen of London," Houston said.
He had the deep, booming voice of a practiced orator, marred by a foreign drawl.
"You do a stranger great honour."
Houston looked across the seats of the Garrick.
"I see we have many gentlemen of Her Majesty's military in the audience tonight."
He shrugged the blanket back a bit, and limelight glittered harshly from the medals clinging to his coat.
"Your professional interest is very gratifying, sirs."
In the row before Sybil, the children were fidgeting. A little girl squealed in pain as one of her brothers punched her.
"And I see we have a future British fighter here as well."
There was a ripple of surprised laughter. Houston checked his mirror quickly, then leaned over his podium, his heavy brows knitting in grandfatherly charm.
"What's your name, son?"
The wicked boy sat bolt upright.
"Billy, sir," he squeaked. "Billy, William Greenacre, sir."
Houston nodded gravely.
"Tell me, Master Greenacre, would you like to run away from home and live with Red Indians?"
"Oh, yes, sir," the boy blurted, and then, "Oh, no, sir."
The audience laughed again.
"When I was about your age, young William, I was a lad of spirit like yourself. and that was the very course of action I pursued."
The Kino shuffled behind the general's head, and a coloured map appeared, outlines of the various states of America, oddly shaped provinces with confusing names. Houston checked his mirror and spoke rapidly.
"I was born in the American state of Tennessee. My family was of the Scottish gentry, though times were hard for us on our little frontier farm. And though I was born an American, I felt little allegiance to the Yankee government in far Washington."
The kinotrope displayed the portrait of an American savage, a mad-eyed, staring creature hung with feathers, cheeks streaked with kino blocks of war paint.
"Just across the river," Houston said, "lived the mighty nation of the Cherokee, a simple folk of natural nobility. I found this suited me far better than a life with my American neighbors. Alas, for their souls were pinched by the greed for dollars."
Houston shook his head a bit before his British audience, pained at his own allusion to an American national failing. He had their sympathy, Sybil thought.
"The Cherokees won my heart," Houston continued, "and I ran from home to join them, with nothing, ladies and gentlemen, but the buckskin coat on my back and Homer's noble tale of the Iliad in my pocket."
The kinotrope shuffled itself bottom to top, producing an image from a Grecian urn, a warrior with a crested helmet, his spear upraised. He bore a round shield with the emblem of a raven, wings outspread. There was a light pattering of impressed applause, which Houston accepted, nodding modestly as if it were meant for him.
"As a child of the American frontier," he said, "I can't claim to have had much fine schooling, although in later life I passed the bar and led a nation. As a youth, however, I sought my education in an ancient school. I committed every line of the blind bard's book to memory."
He lifted the medal-strewn lapel of his coat, left-handed.
"The heart within this scarred breast," he said, and thumped it, "still stirs to that noblest of stories, with its tales of valor to challenge the very gods, and of unstained martial honor that endures till death."
He waited for applause. At length it came, though not as warmly as he seemed to expect.
"I saw no contradiction in the lives of Homer's heroes and those of my beloved Cherokees," Houston persisted.
Behind him, the Greek's javelin sprouted the dangling feathers of a hunting spear, and war paint daubed his face. Houston peered at his notes.
"Together we hunted bear and deer and boar, fished the limpid stream and raised the yellow corn. Around the campfire, under open skies, I told my savage brothers of the moral lessons that my youthful heart had gleaned from Homer's words. Because of this, they gave me the red man's name of Raven, after the feathered spirit that they deem the wisest of birds."
The Greek dissolved, giving way to a grander raven, its wings spread stiffly across the screen, its chest covered by a striped shield. Sybil recognized it. It was the American eagle, symbol of the sundered Union. But the white-headed Yankee bird had become Houston's black crow. It was clever, she decided, perhaps more clever than it was worth, for two of the kinotrope bits in the screen's upper left corner had jammed on their spindles, showing dots of leftover blue, a tiny fault, but annoying all out of proportion, like a bit of dust in one's eye. Mick's fancy clacking was working the Garrick's kino very hard. Distracted, Sybil had lost the thread of Houston's speech.
"The brazen cry of the battle trumpet in the camp of the Tennessee Volunteers."
Another kino portrait appeared, a man who looked rather like Houston, but with a tall shock of hair in front and hollow cheeks, identified by caption as General Andrew Jackson. There was a hiss of breath here and there, led by the soldiers, perhaps, and the crowd stirred. Some Britons still remembered Hickory Jackson, without fondness. To hear Houston tell it, Jackson had also bravely fought against Indians, had even been President of America for a time, but all that meant little here. Houston praised Jackson as his patron and mentor.
"An honest soldier of the people, who valued a man's true inner worth above the tinsel of wealth or show."
But the applause for this sentiment was grudging at best. Now another scene appeared, some kind of rude frontier fort. Houston narrated a tale of siege from his early military career when he'd fought a campaign under Jackson against the Indians called Creek. But he seemed to have lost his natural audience, the soldiers, for the three Crimea veterans in Sybil's row were still muttering angrily about Hickory Jackson.